When Doc awoke, he was standing by the fetid lakeside, tethered to John Barrymore Dix. He felt that a terrible burden had been lifted from his shoulders, if only temporarily. It wasn't the first time that he'd shaken free from a nightmare of grief and personal tragedy, nor the 100th. Even when he was fully functional, Dr. Theophilus Tanner walked an emotional tightrope. The white coats of Operation Kronos had trawled him from the bosom of his wife Emily and his young children, Rachel and Julian, in November 1896. They'd removed him against his will to 1998 and had kept him prisoner while they experimented with him. He was never to see his loved ones again, or to know their fates. After 2 years of poking and prodding, drawing blood and giving him electrical shocks, the Whitecoats had decided to be rid of him and his truculence. In December 2000, just before the world flamed out, Doc was sent forward in time to the grim future called Deathlands. Biologically, Doc was still in his late 30s, but he looked twice that old. A man could only take so much pain, so much loss, the lack of control over anything that mattered to him. Once that limit was reached, the only refuge was madness. Though his memories of the most recent events were largely blurred, he retained a few clear images. He recalled the nameless ville they had happened upon, and the pit of the dead, marked by the upraised hand of the female corpse. He recalled the infant and its mother, whose final desperate agonies had shocked him into reliving his own mind-shattering loss. Less clearly, he remembered the start of the companion's long overland pursuit of the villains, and how with every step his anger at being trapped in a universe so infinitely perverse seemed to build, and finally to turn inward. More vaguely, he recalled J.B. towing him and caring for him like a child. Gradually, over the next few minutes, his full power of thought returned to him. He was a man with a classical education, a highly accomplished 19th-century scholar, a trained scientific observer. He saw that all his companions seemed to be dazed and confused. The cold hearts from the Carney were in the same state. The immature Sticky was in the worst shape of any of them. Doc had never seen a terrified Sticky. It was an unnerving sight. He untied the rope from his waist and reached down to help JB up from where he lay sprawled in the mud. For his trouble, he was roughly shoved away.
"Whatsoever is the matter, John Barrymore? Are you injured?"
As he rose, the armorer pointedly turned his back to Doc. Doc tried to thank the man who had protected him, but JB refused to acknowledge his existence. Behind his wire-rimmed glasses, JB's eyes were narrowed slits, and his jaw was set hard. Doc looked at Mildred and Christy, hoping to get a more friendly reception, if not some sympathy or an explanation for the rejection.
"Dear Dr. Wyeth, Christy, what in heaven's name has come over John Barrymore?"
Evidently, the same thing that had come over them. Neither woman would speak to him. They looked through him as though he weren't even there.
"Well, if that is the way you wish to be..."
He bent and retrieved his precious ebony sword stick. J.B. had dutifully carried the antique weapon for him this far, only to let it drop on the bank when he fell. He carefully wiped it clean on the hem of his frock coat. Doc then removed himself from the company of his infuriatingly silent friends and leaned against the trunk of one of the stripped trees. For a painful moment, he considered the possibility that what he was experiencing was just another mental aberration, another waking nightmare. This time, perhaps, he had slipped even more deeply into madness. He was jolted by the memories of seeing the yellow snowfall and the bizarre lake storm. Memories that supported a diagnosis of insanity. The old man had to know whether he was still dreaming. He unsheathed the sword hidden in the stick and drew its razor edge ever so slightly across the back of his middle finger, just above the knuckle.
Ah!
The blade tugged at his skin, then cleanly sliced through.
"Why, this is no phantasmagorical delusion, in the least. I am, perhaps, sane after all."
The wound bled. From the distance, there came an insistent, repetitive banging. It was accompanied by an odor that Doc couldn't place, but something unpleasant was burning. It seemed to animate both the companions and Carneys. Everyone started moving slowly away from the bank, and the direction of the banging and caustic stench. Doc caught up with Ryan as he too fell into line. He took hold of the man's broad shoulder.
Ryan, dear boy, can you understand me? I fear we are all in terrible danger. We must get away from this place at once. Can you hear what I'm saying?
The one-eyed man roughly pushed his hand away. The expression on his face made Doc draw back. Ryan had never given him a look like that before. It said, "Touch me again and I'll chill you." Doc quietly let all the others shuffle past him like zombies.
Why am I alone, unaffected?
Bringing up the rear, Tanner followed the ragged line down the mountainside. The steep limestone slope had fractured into huge, smooth blocks, and it had been eroded from within, hollowed and honeycombed by centuries of seeping groundwater. As he descended, Doc kicked loose an avalanche of rock that tumbled into one of the gaping potholes. At the base of the slope was a small vill. It looked like a trash midden heaped up around an ancient concrete blockhouse. Ahead of him, the others crossed the dirt square and lined up in front of the flaming burn barrel and the wild man pounding on its side with a round chunk of firewood. Doc stepped wide right and moved closer to get a better look. Shouting and dancing to his own erratic rhythms, the black giant bent to pick up a big gray glob from a pile sitting in the dirt and threw it on the grate where other chunks sizzled and smoked. The objects being seared were the size and shape of pre-dark bowling balls, or human heads. The black flies seemed especially partial to the ones on the ground. When Doc's turn came to partake, he quietly gathered up his share of the charred stuff. He wasn't hungry, just curious. Moving away from the others, he used his sword stick to cut the piece in two. He couldn't identify the material as animal or vegetable. It had a slippery, rubbery texture like raw liver, and was laced with branching veins and tough sheets of sinew. The powerful aroma of urea it gave off so turned his stomach that he had to hold it at arm's length. Then something moved on the cut surface.
By the three Kennedys! What have we here?
He pried loose a translucent, worm-like creature. Eyeless and spineless, it was 8 inches long when fully stretched, and sprang back into a tight coil when released. Doc dropped the parasite in the dirt and crushed it to a pulp beneath his heel. He pushed the two halves of the meat back together and rolled them into the doorless entry of a plastic lean-to. Turning back to the square, the sight of his dearest friends eagerly gorging on the contaminated food made his skin crawl. He hurried over to Christy and tried to take her half-eaten meal away from her.
It is full of parasites, dear girl.
For his concern, he received a quick, hard punch in the solar plexus. Christy tore off another greasy chunk with her teeth and poked it into her mouth with her fingertips. Chastened and humiliated, he retreated to the scant shade along the front of the blockhouse. It appeared that his companions were suffering mass mental illness. They all presented the same symptoms, which could have been caused by a shared trauma or by exposure to some infectious agent. The scholar knew he had to uncover the cause before he could come up with a cure. After the meal, everyone in the square except for Doc and Jackson fell asleep. As it turned out, the only other creature who wouldn't eat the awful stuff was the young Sticky, which was most curious. A discriminating Sticky was something Doc had never seen nor heard tell of. The naked mutant stood resolute guard over its snoring, red-coated master. After a few minutes, Doc heard the sound of a wag approaching from the north. A battleship-gray Baja bug rumbled over a rise and roared over to the square. Like a pack of dogs, the sated diners stirred from their beds in the dirt. They rose to their feet as the bug stopped. Its doors opened, and four men piled out. Doc's attention was drawn to the driver, a tall, thin man in a tattered straw cowboy hat and scratched wraparound sunglasses. He wore his dark hair in a long braid and had a snaggled goatee beard. His clothes were ripped and filthy. From the way the black cook prostrated himself in greeting the driver, Doc assumed that he had to be the Ville's headman. Doc was struck by the way the faces of the companions, as well as the chillers, lit up in the man's presence. Everyone seemed thoroughly delighted to see the man. If Ryan beamed at the driver as if he were a lifelong hero, Mildred's response was even more surprising and unsettling. Mildred sidled up to the man and slipped her arm around his lanky waist. She fawned on him in an overtly sexual way that was absolutely contrary to her nature. The Dr. Mildred Wyeth that Tanner knew was a self-contained, self-sufficient woman whose stoic and clinical reserve was the stuff of legend. She never fawned over anything or anybody. While he pondered this, the crowd moved away from the bug, leaving it unguarded. With no one to stop him, the old man wandered over to the driver's door and looked inside the open window. There were no keys in the ignition. They weren't necessary. The ignition had been pulled apart, leaving the ends of two bare wires hanging under the dash. Duck straightened and looked over the roof. Before anyone could stop him, he knew he could easily slip behind the wheel, start it up, and drive the horseless carriage away. Once he got rolling, he would be free. But he made no move to escape. He couldn't abandon his friends to whatever fate had in store. From the middle of the square, the driver addressed the rapt crowd in a soothing voice.
"My name is Kerr. I'm the Baron here. Now that you've been fed and rested, there's work to be done. Most rewarding work, as you will soon discover. Follow me."
The throng cheerily set off to the foot of the limestone slope. Baron Kerr stopped at a wide gash in the rocky hillside, the entrance to a natural tunnel.
"Everything comes from the burning pool. Above us, it is the wellspring of our existence here. Its flesh becomes our flesh, and our flesh becomes its flesh. Our meaning and destinies are intertwined. Everything you will see inside the cave belongs to the pool. It lives both inside and outside the mountain. Its miraculous filaments wind through solid rock, growing, nourishing, enlightening."
They were being treated to a stock speech that had been given many times before. The Baron was like an aged professor droning out the same lecture for decades. Kerr's deadpan delivery didn't bother any of the others, though. On the contrary, they hung on his every word and appeared eager for more. The Baron removed his sunglasses and set them on the brim of his straw hat. It was then that Duck noticed the man's eyes were different colors. One yellowish-brown, the other blue, which gave him a decidedly deranged look as he waved his arm and led the flock into the huge grotto. Jackson refused to enter the cave. No one tried to coax the Sticky in. No one seemed to care or notice his extreme agitation. Doc found it difficult to feel sympathy for the creature, knowing full well its genetic predilection for violence and bloodshed. Like the others, he wished the damn thing would just go away.